Good morning, folks. I think we should begin. I think that clock is not correct. I think it's already a few minutes past, you know, 11 o'clock, so we should start. Well, anyway, welcome to our convocation this morning. I have this special privilege and pleasure to introduce a rather unusual speaker this morning, and I'm going to tell you about some of things about him. I haven't met him before, but I just had a small conversation. He seems to be a very interesting person. I have some written material about him, realizing that to know or to learn about someone or some person is to know about his work. Now, therefore, it may be a good idea to just get to know who he is and what he has been doing, even though this has about a page or so. I'd like to just introduce him by using this material. The Reverend Mitch Glasser is the person who will speak to us, came from New York City. He attended high school and then also enrolled in the early part of his life at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. And then he became a Christian. In the fall of 1970, two of his closest friends, also Jewish, became to believe in Jesus. And then Mr. Glasser made the same decision around Thanksgiving of that year, 1970. He then met Moshe Rosen, founder and leader of the Jews for Jesus, who encouraged him to get some formal Bible training. The Reverend Glasser moved back east and completed his undergraduate studies at Northeastern Bible College in New Jersey. Then he made his graduate degree, which he earned at Talbot Theological Seminary in California. During his biblical training years, he also served as part of the Jews for Christ, or Jews for Jesus, outreach in New York and in Los Angeles. Upon completion of the seminary, he assumed the leadership of the Liberated Wailing War, one of the organization's mobile evangelistic teams specializing in Jewish gospel music. Mr. Glasser has written more than a dozen of the songs now used in the Jews for Jesus ministry. Since 1976, Reverend Glasser has traveled extensively overseas under the auspices of Jews for Jesus, leading two teams to Northern Ireland, ministering in Argentina, and leading a world tour of English-speaking countries in 1981. This included England, South Africa, Hong Kong, and India, as well as Israel. Now he is based at the organization's headquarters in San Francisco. Mr. Glasser serves as a key assistant to Mr. Rosen, the founder, and he is responsible for recruiting and training of new staff, as well as coordinating new chapters in the United States. He is one of the seven senior staff who serve on the Jews for Jesus Council, the strategy-making arm of the ministry. His organizational skills and commitment to Bible education has also earned him a place on the board of trustees of Northeastern Bible College in New Jersey, which is his alma mater. Presently, Jews for Jesus has 100 staff members based in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Toronto, Canada, with branch commitments to Boston and Miami as well. In commenting on the effectiveness of their work, Mr. Glasser said, "We were only a handful when the Jews for Jesus began, but we have seen many Jews investigate the claims of Christ and conclude that he is the Messiah of Israel. No longer do we hear the question, Jews for Jesus, whoever heard of such a thing? More often we hear, it's how can you be Jewish and believe in Jesus?" Now that's the question we like to answer. In fact, the last statement, how can you be Jewish and believe in Jesus, perhaps can be considered as the theme for his address. Now, as usual, you know, we have some time for questions and answers after his presentation be made. I hope, I'm sure we will enjoy his presentation and learn something new. And perhaps you may brush up your Hebrew as well. Yeah. So may I introduce Mr. Clark.
Shalom. That's not bad. Let's try one more time. Shalom. Okay. And wholeness and peace be unto all of you in the name of our Lord Jesus. It's good to be with you to share what's most important in my heart, and that is the evangelization of the Jewish people. And it's a particular thrill for me to be here at the seminary. Quite often, Jews for Jesus is invited to speak at LCMS churches. We've had a good working relationship denominationally throughout the country. And it's good to see, for me at least, from whence many other pastors come. And it's a great privilege to be able to share with you at this point of your training on the possibilities, the potential of reaching out to the Jewish people in the various communities that God will call you to serve in. Just a couple nights ago, I was at Bethany Lutheran Church, which is a Missouri Synod church down in Overland Park, Kansas. And it's an extremely Jewish area. And I was able to share with a number of people for some time on how they could be witnessing the message of Christ's love to their Jewish neighbors. I thought it would be appropriate then to begin by telling you how I came to be a believer in Jesus, and just sharing briefly my own personal testimony in search for God. I was brought up in the Holy Land, New York City. You thought it was St. Louis. And I was brought up in a traditional Orthodox New York Jewish home. Now, what you need to know about a traditional New York Orthodox Jewish home is that people aren't very religious. You see, you might imagine that many of the Jewish people in New York City, many of the Orthodox Jewish people, sort of stepped out of a Chaim Potok book, still wearing black jackets and hats. When in fact, it's not really true. The Jewish community is as irreligious as the Gentile community. And I was brought up in a very Orthodox synagogue. As a matter of fact, I never even attended a Reformed synagogue until I was 21 years old. And then I think I've only been in two Reformed synagogues in my entire life. And growing up in this home, I learned the traditions of Judaism. I went to Hebrew school from the age of 8 until 13. Now, Hebrew school, especially in the Young Israel movement, which is a very Orthodox movement, Hebrew school was usually 2 hours an afternoon, 2.5 hours an afternoon, 5 days a week, mandatory attendance at Friday night and Saturday morning services. So I got a good dose of my Jewishness by the time I was bar mitzvahed, which happened at the age of 13. Now, I come from a mixed family. It's not that my mother or father, one is a Jew and one is a Gentile. It's just that my mother was from a very Orthodox home. My father was from a non-religious home. This is a mixed marriage, you see. And to compensate and acquiesce to my strong matriarchal grandmother, they sent me to this very Orthodox Hebrew school. So in the home, we were not particularly religious. We celebrated all the major Jewish holidays. But we were not particularly religious. I can remember coming home, sitting down for a serious talk with my father. And I would be wearing a yarmulke, and I would be wearing fringes coming out of my shirt. And I would sit down and say, "Now, Dad, you've got to get yourself straight. 13 years old and become an Orthodox Jew." Of because that's what I was learning in Hebrew school. But as time went on, my mother stopped keeping kosher. And I think at the age of 15, we even let bacon into the house. And about that time, we moved to the suburbs of New York, New Jersey. And in New Jersey, I first really became aware of my Jewishness. The reason is because I was for the first time surrounded by Gentiles. So you never think of it much in New York because there are 3.5 million Jewish people. When it was a Jewish holiday, whether it be New Year's or the Day of Atonement, the schools all closed, which was a great deal because the Jews also got off for Christmas. And so when I came to New Jersey, I felt like I stood out more. And I began to see that there were a lot of differences between Jews and Gentiles. The only person who ever tried to witness to me in high school was a young Lutheran kid who was in a basketball league. And he kept trying to get me to visit his church. Well, finally, he lured me over to his church, which was near my high school, because it had a basketball court in the church. He said, well, you know, come on over. And so me and another Jewish friend went, and we played some basketball, and then he wanted to show me around the church. And he said, you know, now that cross symbolizes the death of Christ, and then, you know, he went from place to place, said, this is a sanctuary, and he showed off the organ. It was the only way he knew how to witness. I think that's what he was trying to do. I mean, he had no idea on how to tell us as Jews about Christ. My only reaction to the whole thing was I felt uneasy walking through the church because, you know, like being on enemy territory and you just didn't know what was going to happen next, if there was some rite you'd have to go through before leaving the church. Or you got to realize Jewish people have no concept of what goes on in a church. None. To this day, neither of my parents has ever been inside a church. Not even inside. Some Jewish people are so firm in that they won't even visit St. Patrick's Cathedral. So it was a very strange experience for me, but it obviously sticks out. It was the only attempt anybody ever made. I went to college at the age of 18 and majored in unregistered pharmacy. And that was 1970. You'll get it slowly but surely. And you got it now. And I dropped out within one semester at the University of Bridgeport. It was very stormy times, 1970. It was a lot of upheaval and unrest and dissatisfaction and searching. And I can remember every day a different march coming down the middle of my campus. And, you know, I just said, there must be more meaning to life. So I went to my guidance counselor. He called me in and said, you know, you have to start thinking about a major. I wasn't even 18 yet. I said, well, do you have a major in life? And he smiled. And I said, not really. I said, I've just got so many questions, you know, that I can't decide on what I want to do the rest of my life. He says, well, you just have to pick something out. So I dropped out of school. And then, you know, the call of Horace Greeley, remember what Horace said? Go west? Yeah. He didn't mean stop in St. Louis or Denver. He meant keep going. So I dropped out of school, me and my friend Fred Goldstein. Not Irish. And Fred was from the Bronx, D-E-V-R-O-N-X, New York. And Fred and I dropped out of college, which we weren't too entrenched in anyway, and went out to San Francisco. And we joined Fred's brother, Baruch. That's his Hebrew name. And we joined Baruch, which incidentally means blessing, and at the time he was no blessing. After he became a believer, he was a blessing. And we joined Baruch and Baruch's friend, Jan Moskowitz, also not Irish. So you had four Jewish kids in San Francisco, and we decided to build a houseboat. Well, you got to know something. In New York City, Jewish kids don't even know what a hammer is, you know. So, but we built this houseboat, and it floated. And we lived on this houseboat, and we continued to carouse. And then something happened. One of our friends from Bridgeport, another Jewish girl, nice Jewish girl, 17 years old, dropped out of college, came to the houseboat, took one look at the way we were living and said, "I'm leaving. The answer is not in California." And she hitched up to Oregon. She put out her thumb. She got picked up by two Christians. They get her in the car, and she says, "How far are you going?" They said, "We're going up to Coos Bay, Oregon." She says, "Well, I'm going up to Portland. That's a pretty good ride." They said, "You're welcome to come." She said, "Thanks." Got in the car. Well, these people were very tactful. Turned around to her immediately and said, "Do you know Jesus?" She looked at them and gave them the end-all answer. Now, you'll find this if you're doing visitation in a Jewish area. This is the end-all. This is it. The Jewish person will look at you and say, "I'm Jewish." Now, translated, that means, "I don't want to talk about it. And I dare you to keep going." Well, like I said, these people were very tackled. And they just said, "Wow, you're Jewish. That's fantastic. The scriptures are written by Jews. The Messiah is Jewish. That's great. How come you don't believe in your Messiah?" And she said, "I don't know." She says, "I never thought about it." Well, for 10 hours, she couldn't get out of the car, obviously. They told her the gospel. Now, the other night at Bethany Lutheran, I was doing what we call a Jewish evangelism seminar. And much of it has to do with trying to culturally sensitize the church in ways that they can witness to Jewish people, because Jewish evangelism is cross-cultural evangelism. It is cross-cultural evangelism, even in America. And so, let me tell you, these people broke every rule in the book. And God bless them anyway. If you forget anything else I say today, please remember that. You don't need to be an expert. Your people don't need to be an expert. Go out there. Make mistakes. Just do it. If you do it, the Holy Spirit will bless His word. Jewish people will come to know Christ. And sure enough, these insensitive, well, they weren't callous, you know. They just didn't know anything about Jews. Joni got out of the car, and immediately, as soon as she got out of the car, she got arrested by a highway patrolman for hitchhiking and being underage. Boy. So these nice Christians bailed her out of jail, took her back to this kind of farm where they were living with a bunch of other Christians. This was 1970. The books have yet to be written about those days. And within 2 days, Joni became a Christian. Then she began writing letters to Fred and myself, telling us about what she found and what we needed. And I knew something was different from the letters. But I wasn't ready to make any, I mean, it was unheard of. I thought she was brainwashed. I was thinking of calling the police. I didn't know what kind of drugs they had her on. And, I mean, I was a typical alienated Jewish youth at this time. But even alienated Jewish youth don't believe in Jesus. It's deep, culturally deep. And so I began writing to Joan, trying to talk her out of it. And, you know, I had nothing to say for the most part. And I said, "You're a Jew." And she could write back, "What kind of Jew are you?" "Well, not much, but Jews don't believe in Jesus." And my friend, Fred Goldstein, I felt was rather weak about the situation. He went out to Oregon and stayed. Next thing I knew, I'm getting letters from both of them. I thought it was an epidemic. And, you know, they begin praying behind your back, and, you know, and you know, when your two best friends know the Lord, it gets really tight. And so one day I finally threw up my hands and said, "Okay, God, how do I get to you? I'm not exactly sure you're there. See, that's the one thing that was left out of my Hebrew school training. I never learned that men and women could have a personal, intimate relationship with God. It was always through doing what we call mitzvah, doing the commandments. Now, it's not that doing the commandments are joyless duties. They are not joyless duties, and that's a misinterpretation of what Paul has to say about the law. It's not only good, but it's not joyless. And it was delightful to keep the Sabbath. It's delightful to do certain mitzvot. But this one thing to do and do and do, it's another thing to commune and to have that relationship with God. And that's something that I never saw. That's something that I didn't have. I remember once going into a synagogue, and you have to know Orthodox synagogues for this. The other night at Bethany Lutheran, a couple of people came and they said they had just been to a bar mitzvah. Some of their Jewish friends had invited them to this bar mitzvah. And they couldn't figure out. It was definitely an Orthodox synagogue because the men were on one side, the women were on the other side, divided by a curtain. And they couldn't figure out why people got up, walked around, and talked to each other in the middle of the synagogue service. And if you've never been to an Orthodox, conservative and reform are more orderly. But in an Orthodox service, this is the way I grew up, in the middle of the rabbi chanting and praying, you get up and you talk to your neighbor and see how they're doing, and it's a social hour. I mean, you don't bring in a cup of coffee, you know, but you walk around and you talk and see how everybody's doing. They couldn't figure this out. They thought it was so irreverent. And perhaps it is, but that's just the way it's done. But I remember once sitting in a synagogue, and there was this old man who we would epitomize as godly because he knew the prayer book by heart. He didn't even have to read his prayer book, put it down, and was chanting the Hebrew a mile a minute, you know? Went through all the prayers. My father, who is far from being a believer in anything, looked over to me and said, you know, I wouldn't talk to you that fast, nevertheless, to God. Such insight. And you cannot, there's a difference between knowing the ritual and doing it, and even doing it with joy, and yet having that personal relationship with God. Something I never saw in the synagogue, something I didn't see in my home. Something I began to see in Fred and Joan, and it scared me. It not only scared me, it made me want it. And so I gleaned this from the letters, and then I also went up and I saw them, and I prayed, God, show me if you're really there. How do I get to you? Is it through Moses or Buddha or Krishna or myself? Jewish mysticism, anything in the back of my mind is saying, please, not Jesus. I'd have to tell my parents, you know, if I did that. If I became a Buddhist, they may not say anything. It's true. Anyway, I prayed that day, sort of a prayer. That night, I went to a phone booth about 11:30 at night to make a phone call. And there, sitting on the ledge where there should have been a phone book, was a copy of Good News for Modern Man. And I said, Lord, can you give me a better translation? No, I didn't think that. I didn't have the chutzpah, the guts to do that. And I was a bit shocked. Now, you got to realize that the New Testament is about the best-kept Gentile secret there is. Jews know nothing about it. When my wife first started getting interested in God, she began reading the Bible. She got an Old and New Testament from the library, and she put a rubber band between the Old and New Testament just to make sure that she didn't go into those forbidden pages. So I began reading this New Testament. I read it in 4 days. And the first thing that struck me was that it wasn't anti-Semitic like I thought. It wasn't anti-Semitic. Now, my idea of Christianity went back to the stickball courts of New York. Do you know about stickball in St. Louis? Yeah. Well, usually people use them for playing squash or handball. But New Yorkers used to take a broomstick handle and a ball, you know, and then you you play baseball with it. You draw a big square, you know, for the strikes, and you try and hit the ball. Anyway, we used to go down to this park to play stickball. And sometimes a whole gang of Irish and Italian kids, you know, with open shirts and big cross crucifixes, would come down and say, okay, Jews, off the court. And then they call us a few other choice terms. And then we'd fight, and usually there's more of them. And Jews, you know, when it comes to hand-to-hand combat, we're not as good. And since we didn't have advanced technology at that point, they used to whip us pretty good. And that was basically my idea of Christianity. And I figure if these guys were Christians, they read the New Testament, that's probably where they got this whole idea of Jews being Christ killers and all these other choice things. And anyway, so I was shocked to see that the book was not anti-Semitic. Not only was it anti-Semitic, it was so Jewish. It talked about Passover, it talked about tabernacles, it talked about rabbis. I came to the conclusion that it was absolutely impossible for any Gentile to understand this book. And I began to feel at home with Jesus. And I began to have the sneaking suspicion that he just might be the Messiah. And I went back up to Oregon about Thanksgiving time in 1970, and I kept asking questions. And in those days, these people didn't answer questions. They didn't answer questions, they just said, read. So I spent 2 weeks there, and I just kept reading, reading, and reading. And once in a while, they point out, you know, you might want to look at Isaiah 53, you know. But the good news was, or at least the version I ended up reading, had the references back to the Old Testament. So I was able to compare the prophecy against fulfillment, prophecy against fulfillment. And pretty soon, I just came to the conclusion that Jesus was the Messiah. And my life began changing like that. And I remember the day I read 2 Corinthians 5:17, found out why my life was changing, that in him I was a new creation, because the changes were from the inside out. And he began changing me very deeply. As far as doing drugs and the lifestyle I was living, that left within the week. Then he got to work on what he really needed to change. And gradually the Lord led me to Bible school and seminary. And about that time, something interesting was happening. There were a lot of Jews coming to Christ, thousands of them, all over the country. And as I found out from traveling through various parts of the world, it was all over the world. And Jewish people were coming to Christ, and there was a group of us which banded together in San Francisco. Most of us were expatriate New Yorkers. And we gravitated to one another, and Moish Rosen became the leader, because he had the mimeograph machine to print the tracts, and everybody knew that he knew a little bit more about the Bible. Although at 3 months old in the Lord, I was fairly well an expert at that point, I thought. And Moish was working under the American Board of Missions to the Jews, another mission society for the Jewish people at that point in San Francisco, and he had come out to reach the Jewish hippies in San Francisco. What do you come out for? Well, none of us, he didn't lead any of us to Christ. We all came to Christ in these very strange ways. So he became the founder of Jews for Jesus, it was happening, and he kind of stumbled on it and found it. And I don't think he intended to start an organization with a bunch of scraggly people like us. And gradually, more people joined us and started going to Bible schools and seminaries and started getting grounded and rooted in the faith. And people went to, you know, we Jews make up our own minds, I'll tell you. We had people going to Lutheran churches and Baptist churches and every other kind of church, you know. And nobody could say anything about where anybody else went to church. Just an aside, did you hear the story? John F. Kennedy was standing with Golda Meir, and Kennedy said to Golda, after addressing a very large crowd, said, "Golda, you just don't know what it's like being the leader of 200 million people." He says, 200 million people? He says, "Jack, you don't know what it's like being the leader of 2 million prime ministers." So, we made up our own minds about where we went to church and so on. And Jews for Jesus began growing. a few fundamental principles from the beginning of the ministry was to try and really communicate, to try and capture the imagination and the attention of Jewish people so that they would ask questions, so that they would be concerned, so that they would wonder who Jesus really was. It's not like we don't have answers. And you don't need me to stand up today and tell you how to properly interpret Isaiah the 53rd chapter or some of the Messianic Psalms. Any one of you, if you just paid attention in Sunday school, can probably sit down and show a Jewish person enough information from the Old Testament whereby they can come to faith in Christ. It's not like Jewish missions didn't have good literature. We had 97 different tracts on how to prove the Trinity from the Old Testament, or the Messiahship of Jesus. There's hundreds of books, and most of them are pretty good. Problem is many of them are outdated and presented in a language that's not so easy to understand. And they're written to Jewish people from a long time ago. Let me illustrate. There was a young girl who was doing her devotionals with her mom. And they were reading through the Old Testament. See, the mom was going through the Bethel series. And so they were reading through the Old Testament. And one night, the girl became so enamored with the Hebrew people. And she said, who are these people? These people who were in Egypt and then, you know, do they still exist? She says, oh, yeah, that's the Jews. Oh, the Jews. That's the Jews. Oh, the little girl was just thrilled. She said, wow. Well, a few weeks later, they were going along they were in the grocery store and they were on the checkout line. And they were going through the checkout line, and there was a young girl there with a Star of David, a Morgan David, a Shield of David. I'm sorry, sometimes it slips out. She was wearing the Star of David, and the little girl looks at this checkout girl and says, Mommy, what's that on her neck? The mom says, oh, that's a Jewish star. Little girl says, Mommy, is she Jewish? Really? Mother says, yes. Shh. The girl says, wow, she doesn't look that old. You know, sometimes we think Jewish people have just walked out of the Old Testament, haven't had enough time to dust off their sandals or change out of their robes. How do you communicate the message of Christ to a people that have a built-in cultural antipathy towards the gospel and are a changing people affected by humanism and existentialism and rationalism and every other ungodly philosophy in this world? How do you keep up with them and communicate the gospel in terms that they understand? Not easy. Some of the early ways we tried was having demonstration marches in Berkeley. Well, I mean, what else? You know, everybody else was doing it, so we just redeemed the method and lifted up placards that said Jesus is the Messiah and Jesus can make you kosher and Jews for Jesus. Well, the media loved that one. So they grabbed hold of Jews for Jesus and named us. I bet you thought we were brilliant enough to come up with that name. No way. The media did it, and they did it as a slam. They could have called us the kosher people. I'm glad that they didn't do that. We would have been stuck with it. So we began being called Jews for Jesus. We began writing pamphlets because we needed to get Jewish people asking questions. And we wrote, I remember one of the pamphlets in the early days that we handed out in the demonstration marches when we weren't doing the demonstrating, when the political activists were demonstrating. And of course, how many of the political activists in Berkeley do you think were Jewish? If it was less than 50%, I'd be shocked. So we began handing out one tract called Kosher Pigs, you know, because they were anti-police. And we had read Romans 13, you know, so we handed out We handed out kosher pigs. And we had, I've got one on the table, which is entitled, Let's Talk Turkey About Thanksgiving. And after all these years of serving on the Jews for Jesus staff, I finally have my first broadside accepted. And it's called E.T., A Close Encounter of the Friendly Kind. And if you want to have some fun with your youth group, first of all, if they haven't seen E.T., doesn't matter, tell them the story. But you get a bunch of our E.T. tracks. You go down to a theater where they're showing E.T., and as everybody's walking out, you have them hand out the pamphlet. It is a blast. It's just so much fun. We've got this new track called Yeshua, which is the Jewish way to say Jesus. And on and on and on. Well, of course, once Jewish people started beginning to respond and answer and ask questions, we came up with another publication called Issues. And Issues is a second line of literature, which deals with some very serious issues from a Jewish-Christian perspective. And so we send Issues out now to, I think, about 30, 35,000 unsaved Jewish people every other month all around the country. If you have a Jewish person you're witnessing to and you'd like them to receive Issues, you can just send us their name and address and we'll be sure to send them a letter of witness, a personal testimony from one of us, and also put them on the Issues list. Well, Jews for Jesus continued to grow and we established branches in Los Angeles and Chicago and New York City, Boston, Miami. And we do a lot of the nuts and bolts work, visiting, doing personal Bible studies, working with the local churches. But we try and keep a high profile, Because if you keep a high profile, then the interested Jewish people know where to find you. Now, those who are not only disinterested but upset also know where to find you. And but you know, I'll tell you, the squeaky wheel definitely gets all the oil, all the attention. The majority of the Jewish population are not making a ruckus. It's just a few noisy people. And my friends, if you're going to have an effective outreach to Jewish people in your congregations, and I hope that you will, then you're going to have to put up with a little bit of ruckus. And frankly, I feel very sad. You know, when I speak with, I'm understanding and I'm patient, but I feel sad and hurt sometimes when I have a conversation with a parishioner or with a pastor, and they say, well, I've got a Jewish friend, or my church is in a Jewish area, but we're, you know, I don't want to lose this friendship. You know, I know I've worked with someone for 13 years, and you know, I really would like to tell them about Christ. Is there a way, you know, 13 years working with a Jewish person, you know, and they haven't said anything to them yet. See, that kind of stuff. They're afraid of breaking the friendship. My friends, I had to lose my whole family. You know, and Jewish believers, you know, oftentimes end up with no one except the believing community. You know, we can't. What's better, to have a friend in hell or to be able to tell them the gospel? And so, you know, you've got to make that stand, encourage people to make the stand. It's going to be very few people that are going to break friendship. Very few bosses are going to fire you. Jewish bosses are going to fire anyone because they've told them about Christ. They may not want to put up with it a little bit, but they won't fire you. And there are going to be very few rabbinical councils that are going to gang up on your church to tell you to stop evangelizing. And you know what you say if they do? It's part of our religion. It's exactly what they tell you. You know, the Jewish community is ripe, In the last month or so, we've seen, you know, at least a dozen people come to faith in the New York area. Now, who would think Jewish people could get saved in New York? Funny thing, you preach the gospel, you know, and you whack, and you watch it, and you water it, and it springs up. It grows, and people's lives, the most impossible characters can get saved. And even Baruch Goldstein, who leads our New York work. The first time I talked to Baruch Goldstein about Jesus, he had just done some heroin. He wasn't an addict, but he had just done some heroin. And I kept trying to talk to him, and he kept falling asleep. He was so out of it. And a month later, he accepted Christ. You know, my wife is your typical smart aleck, straight A Jewish girl who everybody hates to have in their classes because they always know the answers. They raise the curve, you know. You're a nice Jewish girl, cheerleader, the president of the junior class in high school. Just, you know, the kind of Jewish girl you'd expect to go to Brandeis and become a great lawyer, you know. My wife accepted Christ when she was 15 years old. But Jewish people will come to Christ. There's only one catch. One catch. They've got to hear the gospel. And it's best if they can hear it in terms that they can understand. To put the gospel in cultural terms that Jewish people can understand. Now, question. Yes. Well, I could comment on his press relations. You have to read the rest of his speech. You know, you would believe exactly as he does, that God doesn't hear the prayers of Jews. You know, you tell me, what can God do? Well, he works in his providence. But what can God do without the mediatorship of Jesus Christ? If Jesus Christ is not the mediator between God and man, then what's it all about anyway? So he is our mediator, and he is our way to God. That's what he meant. But boy, did the Jewish community have a field day with that one. They just grabbed hold of it and just ran around in circles and made the guy out to be an anti-Semite, which he's not. So my suggestion is, be careful what you say if it's going to be in the press. That's how I deal with it. I just did an interview last night with an unsaved Jewish reporter for the Washington University newspaper, Student Life newspaper. We're having a big rally there Saturday night. Everybody's invited. We're having a Yeshua rally. And I'll be preaching on Messianic prophecy. Nothing you don't know already, but you might want to come and watch. And it's just remarkable how I could sit down and say very sincerely, now, we believe in Jesus because he's the fulfillment of prophecies like Isaiah 53, and he was pierced for our transgressions. Did you get that? Hold on, let me write that down. And he was pierced, you know, and it'll come out in the newspaper. They've been doing that with us for a long time once we learn how to handle them. But my brother Smith did not know how to handle them. Yeah. Well, Jewish people, for the most part, and particularly the generation that you're dealing with now, do not personalize any kind of antagonism towards someone that is German, necessarily. You just don't think like that. You might do it, feel that way towards Germany, but particular Germans. I mean, Jewish people are not going to hear your name and immediately assume you're German. You know, and I don't want to talk with you. They just don't assume it. So I wouldn't even worry about it. And I'll give you a simple answer. Jewish person says, well, I can't believe in Jesus because of all that the Nazis did, and they're Christians. You know, Jews don't know the difference. You know, Hitler, Willie Mays, Little Red Riding Hood, the Pope, Billy Graham. You know, everybody's a Christian if they're not Jewish. They don't know what a Christian is. So if someone's giving you a hard time saying, well, I think what the Nazis did was horrible, and they weren't Christian, you know, and I'm a Christian. I could tell you the difference if you'd like or not. Or if they say, well, you're German, you say, well, I wasn't there. What are they going to say? You know, Jewish people don't think about collective guilt and, you know, and put it on individual Germans, especially when they're under the age of 40. You know, so don't be paranoid about it. That is, now, that has been a problem in my speaking in LCMS churches, where people have felt uncomfortable because of the history and the heritage. You also don't have to make excuses for Martin Luther. You just say, he got a little touchy in his old age, you know, or you say, I'm not Luther. That's all. You don't have to go into a big explanation of it. Be confident, brothers and sisters, be confident of the Word of God and your own sincerity. And God will use you. Question? Yes?
It seems in the prophet, a Jew oftentimes has to leave his people, his customs, in order to be a Christian. Is there a way that we can help him to convert the people along with him, his parents, his sisters, and brothers, so that he's not left without this?
Excellent, excellent question. We never encourage, when we lead a Jewish person to the Lord, we never encourage them to leave the synagogue. Now, that might sound strange because, I mean, we do encourage them to go to church, but we don't, but that's on Sunday in churches, and synagogues on Saturday, so there's, you know, no big conflict. So we don't encourage them to not go to synagogue to get uninvolved in Jewish community affairs. Ever since John chapter 9, though, where the blind man's parents were concerned about being found to be sympathizers with Jesus, they were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. See, Jewish believers don't usually leave. They're asked to leave in many different ways, like getting dues checks returned, not being asked on certain committees. Now, you can't expect unbelievers to act like believers, and you can't expect Jewish people to be kind about the matter, and we understand that. But if you, as pastors, would encourage Jewish people to remain in their community as long as they can, and it won't be for too long, to remain as long as they can, I think they would have a better chance to witness, because it's those early days of being a Christian, of dynamic change in their life, that the people that they're in association with will be able to see, and that'll be so dramatic. Now, I also think that churches should realize that when a Jewish person accepts Christ and they're eased out of their own community, that the church has got to fill that gap. You've got to become family to the Jewish believer. Let me give you an example. I was back home in New Jersey for a week of preaching, and my grandfather died. He lived in Miami. And he died, and they were bringing the body up to be buried. And it was just a strange thing that I would be in New Jersey at that time. And they were bringing him up to New Jersey in my mother's home and then bury him. And the last time I had seen my grandfather, which was, I think, 6 years ago, he slammed the door in my face. And old Russian Jews, you know. And Jewish tradition has a custom called sitting Shiva, where you sit and mourn with the bereaved for 7 days. And there's a lot of different customs that go along with it, but it's so that they would never be alone. They wouldn't have to cook their own meals. It's a real good custom. And my grandmother found out that I was in New Jersey and said, he can't come to the funeral and he can't sit Shiva. Grandpa wouldn't want it. So, I don't know if Grandpa wouldn't want it or she wouldn't want it, but I had to pack up my clothes and leave my home that day and go find someplace else to stay. And I was there the whole week preaching, and I couldn't go sit shiva. Now, my home church is in New Jersey, and if my pastor, who's a very godly, sensitive man, would have known, he would have been with me. I know he would have done what he could to make sure he saw me every day for that seven-day period and prayed with me and spent some time to comfort me. I know it. But I wasn't just going to go over and call him up and explain Jewish customs at that time, you know, the whole bit. And so I was alone pretty much. My wife was in San Francisco. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible time because my grandfather had hardened his heart to the gospel. It wasn't just that he died, that he died without faith. And I had to contend with all that. And I think that as pastors, it's good to learn about Jewish life. And there are different books you can get. But to learn more about Jewish life, you can ask your Jewish believer or believers to teach you about Jewish life. I'll tell you one of the loneliest times in the world for a Jewish Christian in your church. Christmas Eve. First of all, Jews don't know what to do with it anyway. They're not brought up, you know, they don't know. And the whole church is, you know, having Christmas Eve. And the Jewish believer, you know, doesn't know how to do it right anyway. They're still confused as to whether or not they should be celebrating Hanukkah or Christmas. By the way, you should encourage them to celebrate Hanukkah and Christmas. Hanukkah is perfectly fine. Besides, maybe you should celebrate Hanukkah too because you get 8 presents instead of 1. Now, you should encourage them to become part of your family on Christmas Eve. You see what I mean? Bring them into your home on Christmas Eve. And that'll mean something to them, so they can feel part of the family. Because, you know, it's on those holidays when church families, in a sense, break apart into their own individual units. And the Jewish believer has nowhere to go, for the most part. So there are a lot of things like this you can be sensitive to. Question? Yes. Yeah.
You make a distinction between Jewish people who are ethnically Jewish and those that are religiously Jewish,
you know, follow the faith. Well, Judaism is a big ball of wax. The best way to understand Jewish people is to understand them as a people. Don't look at Judaism or Jewishness or whatever. Think of it as a people. Now, within a people, there are different factors. You know, religion, history, heritage, culture. And there are all sorts of things, race. You know, there's all sorts of things in being a people. Nationalism. You know, I'm a Zionist, but I'm not a Zionist for any theological reason. You know, is it more Christian to be a Zionist than a non-Zionist? Is it more Christian to be a Republican or a Democrat? No, Jews think all Christians are Republicans, you know. They do. I had one woman in Florida say to me, she said, I am not going to become a Christian. I've been a Democrat all my life. And I don't like Jerry Falwell. That was her reason. Deep understanding of the faith, huh? So understand Jewish people as a people. Some emphasize different areas, see? Some emphasize culture, some emphasize religion, some emphasize a few of them. As Jewish believers, obviously we're not very good Jews according to Orthodox standards. But we also have, we're part of the people, so, you know, there's the culture and heritage, history, and so, you know, as Jews who believe in Jesus, you know, we still have a whole lot of that. But the religious end of it has changed quite a bit. Yes, sir.
Mostly
evangelism.
Churches like our churches?
Can I just say, before you leave, ladies and gentlemen, I know you have to go to class, but you should receive one of those cards. If you can fill it out before you go, they're right on the end of the table. we're going to send you all a free book, our Yeshua book on Messianic prophecy. We want you to get the newsletter. If you can fill it out before you go, it would be good. Maybe someone who is going to hand those things out can hand them out now, too, if you would.
Like you say,
they
do come to your church.
Yes. Jews for Jesus will come, to your church. We have musical teams like the Liberated Wailing Wall, which sing Jewish gospel music. And some of my best experiences with the Liberated Wailing Wall have been on Sunday mornings at Lutheran churches. We present a program which is almost entirely from the Psalms. And it's a beautiful worship experience. And it helps sensitize and educate your church for Jewish evangelism. We do something called Christ and the Passover. And during Lenten season, you can just imagine that it's just a marvelous thing. We set up a traditional Jewish Passover table, explain the various elements, and tie it into the Last Supper. And we demonstrate the whole thing, and it's really educational and inspirational. We're also involved with doing Jewish evangelism seminars, anywhere from 1 to 4 hours, helping churches learn how to share the gospel with Jewish people. So that's how we try and involve ourselves with the church. But our involvement with the church is very much a secondary focus with us. Primarily, we're involved with direct evangelism. We're a home mission society that thinks and acts like a foreign mission board. Because we really believe that what we're doing is cross-cultural evangelism, sometimes even for us. So we don't think of ourselves as here working in close conjunction with the churches, but rather here doing the work, helping the churches to do the work. But really, we cannot stop having our major emphasis in doing direct evangelism. After a Jewish person accepts Christ, then we try and steer them and work with local congregations to take these believers in as part of their fellowship and work with them. And really, we don't feel that our job is done until they're a functioning member of a local church. But because of this Jewish problem with going to churches, they just don't like going to church. It's hard to get used to it. It's hard to get adjusted to it. Mostly for cultural reasons. So what we have to do is midwife. Nurture people along until they can get into a church, and then we can feel good about it. We can go evangelize and nurture someone else. Yes, sir. Well, I think you virtually have to in order to present Christ, but it's a very sensitive question. Most liberal Jewish people do not believe in a personal Messiah. They believe in the coming of a messianic age. So you can sit down, and I've done it. I've done it, too. I've sat down and presented the case for the messiahship of Jesus, and afterwards have someone say, well, that was good, but I don't believe in a Messiah. And I go, oops. And so I'd say present the messiahship of Jesus anyway and say, well, ultimately, whether there's going to be a messianic age or a personal Messiah, we need to determine that from the Hebrew Scriptures. So let's look through it together to see whether or not it refers to a person or an age. But I would say, many Jewish people believe that there'd be a personal Messiah, but it's not an active belief. Questions? Yes, sir.
Do you have any contact with other Jewish organizations such as Jewish Voice, and so at what level?
Oh, well, with them, every once in a while when we're through Phoenix, as a favor, we'll do the Liberated Wailing Wall, we'll do some songs for them, We try and help out other Jewish missions with our methods and with our material when we can. But there's over 6 million Jewish people in the country, so there's plenty of work, And maybe some of you, maybe the Lord's calling some of you into Jewish missions. And let me recommend the Good News Society for Israel, which is based in Minnesota, which is an inter-Lutheran board. And I'm sure they'd be happy to have your help. We had both the staff, the leader and the staff missionary for Good News on our summer campaign this past summer and participated and helped them in their training. Yes?
Do you often make the objection that Jewish Christianity is a threat to Jewish men as a race? And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I've had people look me right in the eye and say, you're completing the job that Hitler started. You know, instead of doing it physically, you're trying to commit genocide spiritually. It's spiritual genocide. How do I answer that? You really want to know? I look at them right in the eye and say, that's a bunch of nonsense. We cannot answer some threats seriously, or else it gives credibility to what they're saying. Don't answer a fool in his folly lest he think himself wise. And sometimes we cannot answer those things. It's ludicrous. And I suggest you don't answer them either. Do not be defensive. Every Jewish rabbi and community leader and every Jewish person learns from an early age from their mother on how to give a good old-fashioned guilt trip. And that is all that is a guilt trip. So if someone comes up to me at WashU and says, are you just committing, genocide or you're trying to destroy the Jewish race? I say, no, I'm not. I'm trying to present the message of Jesus. It's just a hostile question. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions or materials like for how Christian churches can adapt or Christianize like the Jewish festivals and make them part of their experience, maybe to especially Jewish communities?
Well, the LCMS puts out a Passover Haggadah. But I don't think the LCMS puts out recipes like we do. So there is a Passover Haggadah you can get through the Board of Evangelism, as far as I understand. But we also do present, we have Haggadahs, the Passover liturgy, and recipes. And if you write our office, we could send you that. The book Christ and the Passover explains it in depth, and that's a really good way to do it. I would say if you end up in a Jewish area, just one suggestion, if you end up in a Jewish area and let's say it's the Day of Atonement and you wanted to do something special, one of the things I would do would be to have a day of prayer and praying for the salvation of the Jewish people that are praying for their own salvation. I'd love to see that in the paper. You know, Christ Lutheran Church establishes day of prayer, joining the Jewish people in praying for their atonement. Man. Couple more?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, the Shema is the Hebrew word for one is Echad. I don't know Echad. So Echad is a unity. A man and woman become Echad flesh. Back in Genesis 2, one flesh. So it's a unity, not a singularness. So it is not singularness, it is unity. The two, in Ezekiel, the two sticks become one, Echad. So it was never intended to prove that God was single. Is that clear?
One more.
Yes.
I just wanted to briefly mention when and where Saturday night is going to be.
Thanks, I almost forgot. I have a few flyers, too. Okay. 7:30 at the Lambert Room in Mallinckrodt. The Lambert Room in Mallinckrodt. Mallinckrodt. And if you need more information on it, you can call 727-6099. Perhaps you have some Jewish people that folks in your congregation or even you have been witnessing to. The gospel will be very clearly presented. There'll be some music, there'll be some testimony, and I'll be speaking evangelistically from Messianic prophecy. So, everything that looks free is. the literature, the books are different prices, and I do want to recommend that you get one of our Yeshua pins. And if you want to get into a conversation with Jewish people, just wear the Yeshua pin, which is the name of Jesus in Hebrew, and see if that doesn't open something up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Glasser. I think it was not only interesting, but also indeed informative and educational. I really learned a lot. Now, I tell you, since our dining hall doesn't open until 11:30, now we have a few minutes. If those of you who have some personal interest and questions to him, certainly we have a few minutes here. So you are free to leave, but then at the same time,
you know.
Yes, those cards which you filled it out, you know, leave on the table, and then naturally you are welcome to take some of the tracks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.